Hello everyone, welcome to the first episode of the IPA's new podcast. We're very excited about this one, the Book Club of Great Literature. This is part of the IPA's Foundations of Western Civilization program. Each fortnight we're going to be looking at a different book that is one of the great works of humankind and Western civilization. This week we're going to be looking at Bleak House, and we are joined by IPA Executive Director John Roskam.
Hi, James.
And Sky News presenter Andrew Bolt.
We're doing this every fortnight.
Every fortnight they're going to be coming out, okay? So we'll have a few on the cam. We're recording this a bit early. And thank you to IPA members who've come forward with their questions for this show. But we're going to be releasing them fortnightly. We'll have a reading list hopefully very far in advance. So
John's going to have to read a lot faster than he did Bleak House.
All right, we're already into the back chat. I like it.
At least I finished it.
Yeah. Bleak House, for the people who haven't read it, it's a novel by English author Charles Dickens, first published between March 1852 and September 1853. The novel has many characters and several subplots, but at the centre of Bleak House is a long-running legal case, Jarndyce and Jarndyce, which came about because someone wrote several conflicting wills. Dickens uses this case to satirise the English judicial system. Though the legal profession criticised Dickens' satire as exaggerated, this novel did support a judicial reform movement, which culminated in the enactment of legal reform in the 1870s. So, gentlemen, this is going to be a long-range discussion about what we thought of the book and a few questions that arise from it, but I will start with, and many IPM members have come forward with questions that they want you guys to answer, but first one from me. Gentlemen, first of all, what did we think of the book?
Well, I think while it does satirise the English legal system, I think at the heart of it, it's actually a meditation on love and duty to people and between people, with all kinds of weird permutations from the heartless to the loving. And I think we've got to say, perhaps, rather than the court case, which is one where the wills were, all the money in the wills were exhausted by years and years of nitpicking legal fighting, what I think is at the heart of it is a benefactor, one of the people involved in the this dispute, hires as a guardian or as a companion to one of the two children who's taken on as wards, Esther Summerson, a really loving but self-deprecating orphan. And it's she's the heroine of this. And Dickens writes half the novel in her voice, which is extraordinary as a male author for a start, but also as an author who has, the big knock on Dickens was that he couldn't do female characters. And I think he actually, opinions are divided because some people don't like Esther Summerson. She's too self-deprecating, too self-abnegating. But I think he does it really well, John. This girl who thinks she doesn't deserve of love but gives so much of it, and the travails as she goes through and discovers a big family secret.
Oh, look, I think she's completely annoying. I think Bleak House works despite Esther Summerson, and I need to admit, James, to you, and Andrew knows this, that when we first talking about books, and I think we both agreed Dickens had to be number one, two, or three, we had a long to and fro about, well, exactly which Dickens book it would be. Andrew won. I lost my case for Great Expectations, which for me is still my very favourite Charles Dickens novel. I hadn't read Bleak House, but Andrew said, no, you've got to do it. My wife said, you've got to read Bleak House. It's her favourite book. Everyone in the office said you had to read Bleak House. And I'm glad I did. It's not my favourite, but I think you can now mount an argument that it's Dickens' greatest book, exactly as Andrew said. There's full of great characters. There's great themes. But for me, those themes aren't as significant as the characters. I find aspects of the plot outlandish, exaggerated, spontaneous combustion, really. We can talk about that, and it's a metaphor.
Spontaneous combustion is one of the characters bursts into flames at a critical moment. There have been cases where this is said to have happened, where I don't know, alcoholics got too close to a fire and burned to death.
And Dickens got upset when everyone criticised him for being completely unrealistic. But for all of that, it works for me, and I'm glad Andrew got me to read it, and I'm glad we're starting with Bleak House because the characters are absolutely fantastic.
That's one of the extraordinary things about Dickens. I think there's something like 80 distinct separate characters if you go through the book.
Them halfway through.
Well, but not really, because I think Dickens manages, he's such a master of the telling detail. And then for comic relief, he keeps repeating that detail. Such a master of the comic detail that you don't forget the characters. They are summed up in a word, a phrase, a gesture, a habit. You know, the sternness of some of the charity workers is just extraordinary. I find it so cinematic. There's a cinematic quality to this from the very first start, not just the characters, but if you think of it, the book opens with this marvellous thing about London fog and mud, and it just paints this great London fog. And you can always follow the camera as it goes through this fog and these dirty streets, and it comes closer and closer, like a close-up. And at the heart of the fog sits Chancery, which is the court where this Jarndyce and Jarndyce case is to be heard. And this is a passage that goes through like a page and a half. This is Dickens all the way through. There's a camera that follows people through and picks up on characters that are just, it's so brilliant. In fact, there's too many characters to actually have this as a movie or something like that. It's just too many. But the characters that come into play are ones, like I say, it's a meditation on love and duty. And for me, some of it is the charity sector, the sort of Greens of yesterday.
You've been fired up about that for a while.
Look, it's been fantastic.
And the hypocrisy of the characters who are more concerned about what's happening thousands of miles away in Africa than their starving children at their feet, which is, of course, what Dickens is on about, which is how does a parliamentary system and how does a democracy and how does a growing country allow children to starve to death in the streets of London.
Well, that's exactly right. That's exactly right. You throw so many tempting things out there. Just
but we're not talking about the story, are we?
Well, let's talk about the story.
The
character,
story
the one character in the story that brings it all together, that brings in the aristocracy, because this goes from the top of London society to the very bottom, from the top to the bottom. The one character that brings them in, Lady Dedlock and Sir Leicester Dedlock, who have a tremendous travail in front of them, the aristocracy, to Esther Summerson, and to characters right at the bottom of the tree, and the lawyers and everything, they revolve around one character called Joe, the crossing sweeper, the poorest of the poor. He lives in the tenements called Tom All Alone, which are destroying, crumbling around him, because these are the ones seemingly at the heart of this case. They're the ones that no one can do anything with, because they're the contested will. And he
he's the star of the book. For me, I've got to say, in my years of reading now, over many decades, he's probably the most affecting character I've come across. I'd heard about him. And again, you read some of the commentary on Bleak House and Dickens generally, and they say, oh, look, you know, it's exaggerated, it's over the top. And in one introduction to Bleak House, I read, well, you know, he's the perfect character for the soap opera generation and Kramer versus Kramer and love story. But I defy anyone to read, without giving the story away, but let's give away part of it, I defy anyone to read those couple of pages about Joe's final hours without a tear in their eye.
Well, what's interesting
900
about
pages
that
makes worth reading for two pages of Joe.
Dickens started his career as a journalist, of course. And he also he was lucky to get there because his early life he was devastated when his father went broke and he was sent off to work in a blacking factory, and he always never forgave his parents for that. Never ever forgave his parents for what he thought were his blasted hopes. They'd gone.
And after his parents also funded his sister's music education.
Correct.
And put all of the hopes into the sister, whereas Charles was arguably more talented.
Well, she was quite talented herself and died young, but you're absolutely right. So it was a sort of, particularly with the presumption then that you looked after the son rather than the daughter, so he was completely devastated. But anyway, Joe, Dickens steps out of character in the novel and addresses moral lectures about how could someone like Joe exists in London, so poor, no parents, sweeping crossings for next to nothing, nearly starving, living homeless. How could this happen in the heart of London?
Whereas I think that bit where he steps out of character doesn't work. That's where he starts preaching, and I don't think that's as effective as simply allowing Joe and Alan, the doctor who cares for him, to speak for themselves.
Well,
and that's where he gets a bit preachy.
You know? I actually love it because it gives a moral weight to the whole thing.
Yeah, he hits you over the head with a hammer.
Yeah, but he writes so beautifully on this. But then what's interesting is, so you've got this figure of Joe, and around this cornucopia of Dickens characters, right? And like I say, this is a meditation on love and duty and charity and all those things, how we owe things to each other. Obviously, you've got these courts, the chancery, with this endless Jarndyce and Jarndyce case that only ends when all the money's gone and nobody gets anything. But here you have justice allegedly being done while Joe is starving.
And you have the affection and relations and love of the poor between each other while the aristocracy and the upper class don't care. They live a life of fakery and charade. And again, this is where, while I'm happy to complain about Dickens preaching, this is part of the power of Dickens where, while I think some of his characters are caricatures, he talks passionately about the love of everyone, potentially, not the do-gooders, not the preachers, you know, not the churchmen who got very offended when he talked about this. It's Joe and Alan and Esther and the other characters.
Well, it's interesting, but every character almost is redeemed. Even the aristocracy you say don't care. Well,
you get to grow to like Lester at the end.
Deal. Yes, and even people that seem thick-headed, Sir Leicester Dedlock, turns out to have a heart and a loyalty that is really quite moving. But, you know, here, Dickens, when he steps out of character, he does it almost like Tom Wolfe. Tom Wolfe has just left us. Again, a journalist turned chronicler. Tom Wolfe was a sort of modern Dickens. Let me read a passage that reminds me just so much of some of Tom Wolfe's thing, where he talks about, you know, X-ray wives and all that, you know, these skeletal, starve themselves, skinny kind of fashion. Dickens does a passage that's curiously almost the same. I wonder whether this was an inspiration, but so brilliant. So he talks. So we go from Joe the crossing sweeper to the Dedlock house. You know, these are very rich aristocrats, and so he says the Dedlock townhouse in London stares out at other houses in the street of dismal grandeur and gives no outward sign of anything going wrong within, because as we know, something is. Carriages rattle, doors are battered at, the world exchanges calls. Ancient charmers with skeleton throats and peachy cheeks that have a rather ghastly bloom about them seen by daylight, when indeed these fascinating creatures look like death and the lady fused together, dazzle the eyes of men. And on he goes, you know, forth from this frigid mews come easily swinging carriages guided by short-legged coachmen in flaxen wigs sunk deep into downy hammercloths. I mean, he does those descriptive things, so the cinematic thing, and then you pan into the characters. Now,
But just on that, he does it because he's so angry. I love it. And you can sense the passion and his feeling that these people don't deserve it, that they're hypocrites, that they're living a facade, and of course
they're living in a bubble.
And of course the parallel between that and his own life that we might talk about later is that at the time he was desperately unhappy in his marriage, but he didn't want London and English society and his readers to have any clue as to what was happening behind his closed doors either.
He was very cruel to his wife. But what I find interesting, so it's not just the courts though.
Yeah, have we come to the conclusion the courts are secondary?
They're a metaphor. They're a metaphor for an uncaring. They call this justice, right? But so you got Joe the crossing sweeper. Now you haven't got him just let down by the courts and the politicians, to which and the churches. I mean, Dickens
and people who pretend to care but then don't, and who kick him out onto the streets.
Well, the caring thing. This is so. Dickens is not just angry. He encompasses everything. He's like all of humanity. The comic parts are fantastic because you've also got the charity workers. Joe's there despite all these charity
workers. The
19th
century environmentalists. This is what you want to say, isn't it?
Brilliant types. Mrs. Jellyby, she is great. You know, she's got, you mentioned it before, Dickens calls it telescopic philanthropy. She can see all the way to Africa, but nothing closer. She can't see the children falling downstairs, that they're dirty, that they're hungry, that they're crying. She doesn't even hear it. Her house is a chaos, but she's forever raising money for Africa. And, I mean, it's just incredible.
And,
Mrs. Jellyby.
And she's getting her children to take dictation. And while she writes these endless letters that are an end in themselves that
correct.
Don't even have any purpose.
Correct. That's it. It's all busy work.
It's all
in
busy
order,
work.
She's being good.
She could work for the government.
But she's actually, no one actually knows what the heck that's she's right. does in Africa.
And the children can see through it as well.
And they get very resentful. And this is a common theme, actually. Children are seeing through some of these things. Then there's the other charity worker, another, Mrs. Pardigal. So Mrs. Pardigal, her speciality is going through to people's houses of the poor and reading moral lectures to them.
While they're starving.
Well, in fact, in one particular scene, yes, a baby is dead in the room. She doesn't even notice. She keeps giving them temperance lectures because she, Dickens for her, the phrase is rapacious benevolence. It's like she's stealing her credit from them.
And Dickens, who liked to drink, of course, hated the temperance movement.
Oh, yes. Well, in fact, he makes fun of her because she enlists all her children into her causes and she boasts how Alfred, aged 5, has sworn forever to give up tobacco. And all the boys are so resentful and hitting each other and cross that they've got to give up their money to her causes.
But the thing about Dickens poking fun of these people is that Dickens, again, in his private life, actually did something about it. So,
very
of course,
generous.
He had Urania, the house for so-called fallen women. Mm-hmm. He, and we could talk about this, took up a lot of social causes and he cared about people under his feet in London compared to these people who he was poking fun at, who he said made no difference and only did it for their own self-aggrandizement,
but
nothing
so
else.
Interesting. And then there are other... The Jarndyce, one of the Jarndyces involved in the case, he doesn't want anything to do with it. The case rolls on even though he doesn't want anything to do with
it. The old wise man.
Yeah, the old wise man, too good to actually be true. But he's bludged off by another character, Harold Skimpole.
Oh, you've got to talk about Skimpole. I mean, I think all of us in our own lives have come across
Skimpole.
Some sort of character like Skimpole.
Well, Skimpole,
to be fair,
well,
I don't like
says,
Esther. She sees through Skimpole at the end.
She does. She does. He says, for instance, I almost feel as if you should be grateful to me for giving you the luxury of generosity. So he bludges and he thinks, because you feel so good at giving to him, he feels he's doing you a favour.
And he pretends
so
he's naive and he pretends he doesn't know what he's doing. But
I'm just a child. I'm a child.
Give me more money. Give me more money.
Give me more money. I'm just a mere child.
I can't pay you back.
It is just so wonderful. Dickens has got the whole range of how people, what does goodness mean? And I understand you don't go for Esther Summerson and there's a lot not to like about it. She doesn't feel that she's lovable. But she is, everyone does love her and in the end she's the constant. She is the one who does good. Doesn't seem good. She does good. Practical, good, all the way through. But I have to say, the word little, if only Charles Dickens had scrubbed the word little from his dictionary, this book would be twice as good. He calls little woman, your little woman, little this, little that. Women are always little. His ideal is a little woman, a meek woman, Esther Summerson, which is really weird because his most beloved daughter was anything but.
And while, as I've said, I don't think
she's
she works, there's the Bagnets, Mrs.
Yes.
Bagnet that works, and there are, and even Lady Dedlock at the end.
Yes.
Great
comes, love.
Comes good.
Cool. So
have we explained why we like it?
Yeah, but I think
Andrew, you're convincing me that maybe this could be Great Expectations
love.
Now.
Yeah, well, everyone says it's about the courts, and in a sense
it is,
it's
not
about
really.
Love and duty, and I think it's just, for that is so wonderful. Also bludges, Mr. Turveydrop, another great character, whose great point in life is to...
bludge off his son and his daughter-in-law.
And then his daughter-in-law, who is someone also loves, because he is a model of deportment. again, Dickens forever, you know, pokes fun at a model of deportment. He spends hours dressing himself up because once, I believe, the Prince of Wales noticed him. And so his duty is to go through life being a model of deportment to others, including his son.
And let everyone else look after him.
Exactly right.
Okay, brilliant. So we'll now go to some questions that IPA members have sent through. So we've already touched on Esther here, but we've got a few questions about the book, a few questions about Dickens and his time, and a few other questions about some wider themes that are available that we might have time for at the end. But we'll go to this question from Ian Harper. So one question I'd like to ask is whether Andrew and John think John Jarndyce had designs to marry Esther from the outset and had arranged for Richard and Ada to live with him to legitimise an arrangement that would otherwise have appeared unseemly. Ian goes on to say, he's always portrayed as such an upright fellow that I'd often wondered whether his intentions in bringing Esther to live with him were entirely honourable. It's well known that Dickens himself had a penchant for younger women. Whether he behaved as honourably as John Jarndyce when it came to dealings with his own wife?
He acted extremely dishonourably with his wife. He made out like his wife, there was never a meeting of minds, and she was boring and all that, and she let him down and was awful, when in fact the contemporary records at the time suggest she was an inspiration, a great critic of his work, was a model on its tour in America. Commentators repeatedly said, hello, you know, she really bucked him up, and she was so kind and all that. And then he fell in love with someone else, so he treated her like rubbish.
She had 10 children, and then he was resentful of the children. And as lots of people said then and now, he acted as if he had nothing to do with those 10 children coming into the world. I agree.
No. Actually, he had a very loving relationship. His daughters absolutely
idolized him. One of the daughters liked him, but then there was another one who absolutely hated him. And I agree with Ian that there is something a little bit spooky about a bit creepy about John Jarndyce and Esther. And again, this is one of the things that I think does work in Dickens. He doesn't ever exactly explain what the court case is about. We know it's something to do with a will, but we don't know exactly. And he keeps on saying these are cousins, so presumably they're distant cousins. We never really get to the bottom of how this bloke living in this mansion gets to be looking after these cousins as wards of Chancery. And there is a little bit of darkness that hangs over that relationship. But I'm glad that in the end, Esther does get to marry Alan, and that in that part of the book, at least, has a bit of a happy ending.
Look, this is one of the creepy parts of the book that I think Dickens, the fantasist, as in his
Dickens,
own
Dickens, the guy living a double imposes, life, nearly.
Yes. We have John Jarndyce, one of the participants in this, unwilling participants in this legal action. He takes up two wards, as you say, two distant cousins, and hires Esther to be the companion of one. And he falls in love with her, proposes marriage. She's so grateful because she doesn't feel... I think if you see her as a terribly damaged person who was abandoned by or lost her parents, raised lovelessly by a relative, treated like dirt... then sent off as a governess. I can imagine that's a damaged person. I don't know whether Dickens intended it to seem so, but that's why I can forgive her in a way you can't. And he falls in love with her and she agrees because a sense of duty and gratitude to everything he's done for her. And then he hands her off. Well, maybe we shouldn't.
You can't marry people for gratitude.
And I do find that a bit yuck. But then, given that that is described through Esther Summerson's eyes, I don't know that you can then say Dickens is blind to that because he's talking through Esther. You're entitled to see it, but I don't know. And so I think if I'm being generous, I can go past that. But I do think he's a bit of a strange person after all, John Jarndyce.
And Jarndyce does want to exercise these controls over his wards, over Richard. He tells Richard what careers to take. He does give Richard good advice, but again, we don't know whether he really means it, which is give up on the court case, develop a profession. And Richard is one of the most pathetic
characters.
He gets sucked into
the court case, thinks he can earn some money from it. His life is destroyed. But here again, like I say, the whole book, while it's the court case, is a meditation on the kinds of love and charity and duty to it. He owes... His other cousin, the two cousins fall in love. He owes her a duty of care, of love. He says he loves her, but he doesn't do anything about it.
And Ada puts up with it.
And but again, there's a dependency. And you know, Dickens is frank about that, or through Esther is frank about exactly that, that Richard is a user and a loser and a loser, a loser, a loser. Yeah. And all this, like I say, there's so many. You have a look at Lady Dedlock and Sir Leicester Dedlock. Sir Leicester Dedlock looks like a complete numbskull, trading on his family and his fortune and his reputation, completely proud.
And having these
and turns out to have depths that Richard Carston, the ward, who's presented initially as a loving, charming person who sees through all this, he does not. And I think Dickens is brilliant in that. He sees us in our entirety, even if, as you say, he himself is imperfect.
Okay, cool. We've got a second question here from Ian Harper. So, a second question concerns Mrs. Jellyby, whose, quote, telescopic philanthropy, as you were talking about before, is often said to be modelled on Caroline Chisholm, who, if people don't know, is a progressive 19th century English humanitarian, known mostly for involvement in female immigrant welfare in Australia. Given that she's generally held in high regard in this country, I know she was on the $5 note for a while, what was it about Chisholm that particularly irked Dickens, and how did she come to his attention?
Well, we know that Caroline Chisholm met Dickens on a number of occasions, and that Dickens was a great proponent of immigration to places like Australia, South Africa and Canada as a way of renewing people, as a way of allowing some of the underclass in London and Britain to escape. I used to like Caroline Chisholm, and there's a great new biography out of her. I must say, after reading Bleak House, and if Jellyby had anything to do with Caroline Chisholm, I think a bit less of Caroline Chisholm. But again, it was this willingness and desire not just to do good, but to be always talking about it, to be always wanting everyone to care as much about it as you, to be always at you. And Caroline Chisholm was famous, certainly here in Australia, for always being at the governor and always being at people.
Someone
who
else
could,
had to do yeah, something.
Yeah, so, someone else. And again, it goes to this point that we've made, which is Dickens' anger. That there's all this talk about it. Everyone's
not just saying he's laughing at them as
well. But the laughter is based on a very deep resentment that there's nothing happening for the working poor. There's nothing that happened to him when he was working in the blacking factory at the age of 12. Nothing is happening while people were dying of cholera. He got very fired up about the Crimean War, which happened just after Bleak House, when he said, well, look, it's all great. We're off to, you know, secure the straits to India and so on. But what about what is happening right here, right now?
And as you know, in this book too, any minister of he professes to be a Christian and loves Christianity, but nobody who
they
actually
all look
represents
pretty bad,
the
don't
church
they?
ever turns out to be and a good person.
But again, we'll come back to my brand new great favourite character in world literature, Joe, who doesn't know the Bible.
I know nothing.
Who knows nothing, but who starts to utter the Lord's Prayer, which is far more meaningful than any of the sermons in Bleak House.
Well, in fact, the reverend that pops
oh,
up.
Oh, Chad Band and these people.
Yeah. You know, he's just there for the food. It's just incredible. But it's interesting. One of the comic parts of the book, one of the comic sort of setups, is when
Everyone's dying around them.
Yes, exactly right. Is a meeting of all these good people, including Mrs. Jellyby and Mrs. Pardiggle, and a guy who has a curious formation to his head. He falls in love with, or he wants to marry us for some reason. He's one in this crowd too, and she keeps saying it looks like he's got on his skull two horns. Now it's actually, like it's the devil.
Is
really
that just a bit obvious from Dickens?
Well, I still think it was very funny. But, it describes this meeting of this great group and, they took a multitude. He says, they were going to raise new buildings. This is a meeting of all these women and a few men. They were going to raise new buildings. They were going to pay off debts on old buildings. They were going to establish in a picturesque building, engraving of the proposed west elevation attached, the Sisterhood of Medieval Marys. They were going to give a testimonial to Mrs. Jellyby. They were going to have their secretary's portrait painted and presented to his mother-in-law, whose deep devotion to him was well known. And then he says, they were the women of England, the daughters of Britain, the sisters of all the cardinal virtues separately, the females of America, the ladies of 100 denominations. This is a meeting of like I say, rapacious benevolence. It's just, you're just all these good people and you just want to flee the room.
And you just want them to do something.
Yeah. So we'll move on to another question. This is coming from Chris Golis. Which character could easily live in our times with just a change of clothes, and who's least suited to life today and why? I know you mentioned
Mrs. Jellyby. Mrs. Jellyby, without a doubt. I mean, and Mrs. Pardigal, you see them all the time, don't you, John?
Half of them are in Parliament.
And half. Good point. Good point. They'd be Greens voters.
They would be, and I'm not going to talk in this podcast about climate change and electricity prices, but that's exactly what Mrs. Jellyby would have been onto if she'd been alive in 2018.
Well, Mrs. Jellyby would be Green MP with a telescope of philanthropy. She could see all the way to the Middle East, but nothing on the streets of Melbourne and Sydney.
Okay, brilliant. This question was submitted anonymously. Do you agree that Bleak House is less well-known than Dickens's works such as Great Expectations, David Copperfield, and A Tale of Two Cities? Why do you think that is? Is it the quality of writing, the literature, or the plot?
John should answer this because it took him 3 months to read the book.
It's 900 pages, Andrew.
I think that explains a lot.
And as I said, look, I always found it daunting at school, and later you look at even Hard Times or Great Expectations, of course, Tale of Two Cities, Oliver Twist, Nickleby, etc. I've got to be honest and say I don't like the title. I mean, it's ironic because, of course, Bleak House is actually quite a happy home, and Dickens contemplated lots of different titles. But Bleak House is always presented as that hard, you know, that difficult, big Dickens novel that you need to read one day, but why don't you do something easier first? But as I said, once I got into it, it grabbed me because, as I said, the story is ridiculous, but the characters are just fantastic.
I also think when you have a look at the other ones that were mentioned there, you know, Pip in Great Expectations or David Copperfield himself, these are people that you warm to. Nicholas,
yeah,
Nickleby.
You follow and you care for you in care a way that you don't quite in Bleak House.
Yes, Samson, as you say, there's something, you know, too damaged about her in one sense. She's really like a mechanism around which this whole whirly gig of other characters spin. So I like all the minor characters and the themes really greatly. But I think you don't have that central character like you do.
But
in
it's interesting.
Novels.
At the time, it sold very well and was one of his best-selling serials. And again, when Andrew said I had to read Bleak House and this would be the first book, and I Googled it, you know, Dickens' best book. Nearly everyone says it is, and
but it's interesting
I can
too,
sort of now see why. But still not my favourite.
But he's actually writing at the time about Karl Marx's too. And about the same kind of things, in a sense.
Very similar, yes.
Yes. And people often say Dickens is a sort of revolutionary who didn't actually have the guts to...
Well, he didn't stand for Parliament because he got asked often and he kept on saying no.
No, and I think that was a wise move because what he did do with his books, it was more...
It was more powerful.
But the point is, in some sense, it's like that bishop who gave that stupid lecture at the wedding of Meghan Markle and Prince Harry. All you need is love. In a sense, he's saying... You don't need revolution, you need love. He had a horror of revolutions. You see that in Tale of Two Cities and in Barnaby Rudge. But here he just says, if only we were better people, things would be better. And while that is trite, it is true. If we actually established our duty to people and knew it wasn't enough to pose as loving or to simply say, like Richard Carston, I love you, there's actually got to be a follow-through.
And the turning out of Joe from various homes and places where of shelter where he was being looked after is a metaphor for that. And again, it's significant that where does Joe end up? He ends up, and again, in one of the, for me, one of the really good characters, George's shooting gallery, where George is not well off. George is struggling. George is not rich. He has been turned away from his family. So who ends up looking after?
No, he's too ashamed to go back.
He's too ashamed, and he looks after Joe. So see, I'd go more than that. I think it's Dickens says, well, we have to love and we have to care. But again,
we have to love and care.
And then do something about
exactly
it.
Exactly right.
That leads us really well into the next question. This is coming from Jeff Hem. So collectivists often cite Dickens as raising awareness of the downtrodden, which they argue justifies socialist policies to lift them up. If not by socialism, how can such a strata of society be helped out of poverty, both in Dickens' day and in the contemporary era?
Well, Dickens wasn't a revolutionary, and some people say, oh, lacked the courage to go through, or, you know, as I say, Marx is writing at the same time. I don't think Dickens ever looks to government to be the big saviour. I think he looks to people all the time, and he admires good people. I mean, in David Copperfield, Betsy Trotwood is a good person. And he keeps stressing our relations to one another. I think that is
In modern political terms, you'd say it's very local, it's very democratic. He hates the system. And lots of people have said that in Bleak House, he's talking about, for the first time, like a whole social system where everyone's connected. There's a little bit of discussion about government. But Dickens's point is the system has failed. It's the Georges and the Allens looking after the Joes that make a difference. It's Esther looking after the children that she does. So, and then I'd go further, which Dickens, of course, doesn't do, and I don't want to be historicist about it, but it's about work, it's about flourishing, it's about meaning, and that's the next step that I don't think Dickens yet makes. But I don't think Dickens ever talked about socialism. He talked about a system that is failing.
He saw failings in the system.
He saw a role for Parliament, and he was friends with many Liberal politicians, and he was actively engaged in aspects of Liberal politics, and he people had been at him to stand for Parliament. But again, I don't, as Andrew said, I don't think he...
Government, he didn't want to blow up the system.
Government was different then. He didn't look to government. He looked to neighbours and families and community. And he hated fake community when, as Andrew said, people went around to the homes of brickmakers and while children were dying would recite complaints about what they were doing or not doing.
So if I could offer one from me. So there's all this conservative idea of like a big society rather than reliance on the government, the reliance on society. So you guys would say Dickens would more be on the favour of the conservative big society side than looking to the government as a way to...
Yeah, I think he saw a proper role for government. I mean, but his idea was more reform than revolution. So he would, for example, in Hard Times, it was the way children were taught. That's what he was really upset about, the cruelty to children, which is always a thing that got his dander up. Here, reform to the legal system. And that came a little bit from this. That's what he was after.
Reform. He hated the workhouses.
He hated Kant and workhouses, and he just wanted people to act better. That's really it. And he didn't look for a nirvana in a overturning society. When you look at Tale of Two Cities, the way he describes the crowds there, you know, with their dancing in the street with their hands held high and their heads held low and howling and wailing as they danced their horrid, you know, he hated the mob.
He hated the mob, but I also think that his views on the French Revolution were not completely solid, because at times he would whisper and utter, well, maybe the French do have it better. And of course, the point about spontaneous combustion is his argument that, well, if we don't fix things, then the society is going to combust. So, yeah,
but that is a point. You're right. He's saying, you know, at some stage, you keep acting like this,
we will get a revolution. We'll get a revolution.
You will pay.
Yeah.
Which is, of course, the argument about the success of British liberal democracy and the parliamentary system as to, while in the middle of 1848 Europe was going up in flames, why did it not happen in Britain? And in Britain there still was some parliamentary outlet in a way that didn't exist on the continent.
Correct, yeah.
Okay, cool. Our next question comes from Susan Leenbruggen. I apologise if I'm mispronouncing that one.
Leenbruggen.
Hopefully that's the way I'm pronouncing it. Okay, so you guys talk about the humour and the sort of poking fun at certain parts of the characters and stuff. Susan asks about our mutual friend. She says, this was Dickens' penultimate novel and it almost completely lacks humour. The tort is somewhat detached prose, lack of sympathetic characterisation and a depressing backdrop, all reflect on a certain disillusionment with humanity with Dickens. Do you sort of see Dickens as he gets older and gets more into
getting
his books,
more bitter and twisted?
Getting more bitter and twisted. Is that something you see in his works?
He gets a little darker. I think he gets more serious. And maybe the, I don't know, maybe the comic invention that you get right from the start with the Pickwick Papers and Nicholas Nickleby and all that kind of stuff, that's hard. That's really hard to keep doing. And it is true, it gets a little less like that, but maybe also he wants to be a bit more the Tolstoy, I don't know.
He wanted to be a bit more serious, but he got frustrated that the critics wouldn't let him be more serious, and his the reading public by and large stuck with him all the way through, but there was a feeling that, look, I can do comedy and I write plays and I do these books. I want to talk about the two Englands. I want to talk about these vast social movements. And again, I, without being psychoanalytical about it. Well, exactly. And but I think it's also a case that his private life and his family life was turning to dust.
And a lot of artists like Trollope couldn't stand what he'd done. It's interesting. That reminds me, you know, Rossini once paid a visit to Beethoven, and his heart was in his throat because the great Beethoven, Rossini was a younger man, and Beethoven looked him up and down and said, keep writing those comic operas, they're great. And what really destroyed, what really stuck in Rossini's craw was that most of his operas to date were allegedly serious ones. Now, of course, we remember mostly his comic operas rather than William Tell and all those, great as they are. But to the end of his life, that hurt him. Rossini knew his genius and his memory was in comic rather than serious. In fact, one of his he wrote a great mass, which he called a little mass, but it was actually quite long. And he said, please accept this humble little thing. People might not like it, you know. When he was serious, he knew that that's not what people wanted.
It reminds me,
Dickens was there too.
There was a wonderful documentary on Bernstein and West Side Story, and he was always frustrated that people knew him as the composer of West Side Story and not as this awesome composer. For most people, if you've composed West Side Story, you've done something very special, but he wanted to be regarded as a serious composer and conductor.
You know what we haven't said, though, about Dickens is that, and it's so easy to forget, he was simply a great writer. He was simply a wonderful writer. You know, he writes of Esther Summerson, I think it is, that she was a noticing child, a phrase that's always stuck with me. I love people who are noticing, particularly noticing children. You know the kind, the ones that are alive to what's happening. Their eyes light up. They've got enjoy. And Dickens, I think, was a noticing man, a noticing child. And it, like lines like where he says of Mrs. Jellyby's husband, who's a total non-entity, sits half the time with his head against the wall in despair and then just, has to find his own dinner when she gets home, which to Dickens is a terrible thing to do. It's said of him by Conversation Kenge, one of the unsympathetic lawyers, the husband is merged in the more shining qualities of his wife. I think that's such a great line. Merged in the more shining qualities of his wife.
I'm going to ask you, Andrew, a question about writing. You, in the course of a week, write many, many more words than I do. And one of the things that I always want to know is then that I Google, you Google, how many words do the great writers write a day or a week? Dickens, I'm sure someone would know exactly how many words he wrote over the course of his life, but for decades he wrote at least 4 or 5 hours a day. He would go for 6-7 hour walks. And it always struck me that when you're talking to younger people about whether it's writing a novel or a research report or an op-ed for a newspaper, they're always waiting for this genius and this spirit of inspiration to come. And the point about Dickens is he did it every single day from the age of 15 or 16.
And he wrote journalism.
Every single day
he did it. Travel memoirs. He wrote plays in which he himself starred.
And he got better. He didn't get worn, because I think young people today sometimes think, here I am going on about young people, think, oh, you get worn down, you've only got so many great words in you. Whereas Dickens had hundreds of thousands of great words.
Exactly. And another great novelist, but perhaps not, just not touched with the touch of genius of Dickens, but a contemporary, is Anthony Trollope.
And we're going to do Trollope later on.
Trollope is a great writer, but he actually got his servant to wake him up, I think some ungodly hour, 5 o'clock in the morning, and wrote and wrote and wrote and wrote and wrote, and then at about 8 o'clock, 9 o'clock, he'd go to work at the post office. He's the guy that actually invented or posted around Britain the red letterboxes that you see. He's the guy that set that up. So he was a great post office official. But now, we give grants to artists so they don't have to do the humdrum of life and they can devote themselves to staring at a canvas. Trollope wrote more books than Dickens by a mile and did it as a post office employee.
And there was an idea of hard work, so Dickens just would have his breakfast at a set time, and whether he was on holiday or at home, he would go to his study or go to a place to work. He would emerge 4 or 5 hours later and then continue on with the rest of his day, and he would do it day in, day out. And, of course, one of the things that upset Dickens about his children is that this example of hard work never seemed, in his view, to be inculcated in any of them.
That's because a genius is a genius, and to have in a family two geniuses is you're against the odds there. So
Andrew, have you just read my notes?
No, I
have
haven't.
I literally, and this is from Peter Ackroyd's biography, which I think is one of the best books on Dickens, and I was actually going to mention this at the end, but I'll mention it to you now. I'm going to say that I'm sitting in the presence of Andrew and James, and so this quote from Dickens about his kids, of course, doesn't apply to the Bolt family. Sons of great men are not usually as great as their fathers. You cannot get two Charles Dickens in one generation.
But it's true.
Except if it's the Bolt.
But it's interesting, you know, what I also find, and particularly since I worked too hard, and James will probably...
Are you suffering from that, James?
You weren't there for us. Don't say it now. Don't say you weren't there for us, Dad. But Dickens had that phenomenal work ethic, and yet his daughters, like one of his daughters wrote Life with My Father, I can't remember what it's called. They remember him being present for them when it counted. And not just like, you know, you're there for me, but he'd be there in the evenings, he'd be there for the parties, he'd be there for their friends. He was always on, and they loved that the shows he put on, the plays he put on.
I'm going to be part of the anti-Charles Dickens faction, and I'll acknowledge...
And there's a big one.
No, and there's a big one and growing, and I will acknowledge all of that. But I would argue that even at that time, it was a bit strange to be sending your 7-year-old son to a boarding school in France for 10 months of the year.
That's true.
To say goodbye to your son to India. No. To say goodbye to your son at the age of 16 and never see him again. But he did like his daughters, and he acknowledged that he loved his daughters more.
But I actually think you're absolutely right to pull me up on that. It's that there is a distinction between the daughters and the sons. And I think this really goes back to – it's interesting. The resentment that he felt to his parents about going to the blacking factory and not being appreciated –
he didn't have a great role model.
It was his father that actually lost the money, right, and his grandfather that was the fraud. But it was his mother on whom he really held the bitterest resentment.
Yes.
And I always think
for not giving him the education that he thought he should
have. All that kind of stuff. And also mocking her when she once went to set up, you know, the family's losing money. She decides, I'll do a boarding school. Total disaster. No one turned up. And total disaster. I lost even more money. But at least she tried. But he mocked her even trying. Well, and I find that really interesting. In his books too, he's always after the ideal feminine. His best characters are ones that aren't ideal women. They're great women, but they're not ideal women. His ideal women don't live. They're pallid. And they've always got the word little attached to them. And his favourite daughter was also not a little. She was a firebrand who married an artist, eventually his second marriage. She was great. She was a spitfire. And he loved her, which is really weird. He had this ideal that didn't exist either in his novels, really. They don't come to life there or outside.
He had four mocking women. I mean, the way he treated his wife after they split, mocking her in an advertisement in the Times, mocking her to his friends. Mm-hmm. A great artist, but not so much of a role model.
No, and she, his wife, though, always
but she stuck with him.
That
she
would come, he would come by and maintain his memory. So there was something lovable about him. He was just on fire, in a way.
So this next question comes from me, actually. So I just want to go back to Dickens' work ethic compared to his children. We touched on how Dickens himself was born into pretty, not great circumstances and worked from a very young age. Do you think having to work that early on and having this writing talent that he had, that it was that's my one ticket out of here, that allowed him to work even harder than anyone else?
But he wasn't exactly born in poverty.
He fell into it later on. Yes,
was fairly senior in the Navy, and then started pinching stuff. His father had a good post in the Navy. We're talking about a time when a lot of people were in real poverty. But then his father lost the money, and then he had that touch of it. He was brought the thing I think that really shocked him was he was brought down in class, right? He lost class and caste in class-ridden Britain. That shocked him. He'd been dropped into a subclass that he, in his view, in word, in mind, and hope had been lost, trying to climb his way out of it. That scarified him. Once he got his chance again, he worked. Part of that is genius. When you're good at something, you like keep doing it. You like to keep doing it. But then taught himself shorthand, reported on Parliament, became a reporter, became an editor. Just
always did more. And apparently he thought in pictures, he thought in stories. And far be it for me to draw any comparison between Charles Dickens and Enid Blyton, but apparently from a very young age, Enid Blyton could just knock off 1,000 words of a story at a time, and Dickens could be doing that from the age of 15 or 16. You're studying Dickens' life and you're thinking of Malcolm Gladwell's 10,000 hours. You're thinking of the Beatles in the basements of Germany's just working, 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 practicing, practicing, practicing until they got really, really good at it. And the thing is, I think he found it hard, but writing was also a release. He lived with his characters. He got upset when he had to kill them off or when they died.
Absolutely.
And he
Little Dorrit yeah, was he the lived one. It. Little Dorrit was the one where
he'd get sick. Yeah.
I always thought Little Dorrit had too much sugar in it. Yeah. But that the death of Little Dorrit is the one that really destroyed him. But it's interesting. I think that 10,000 hours thing works in terms of productivity and works in terms of use of language, you know, you get better. But nothing can explain the noticing
yes.
boy. The way that he could bring a character to life in just a flash. You know, Mrs. Jellyby, you just notice from the very start when you introduce, you go up the stairs, you see children, one child with his head caught in the basement railings, another one falling down the stairs, and you go up to the top and there's Mrs. Jellyby writing letters appealing for people to help in Africa. You've got her.
He just
telescopic philanthropy.
He sees things a bit differently. He looks for different things.
Well, which it's just Mrs. Jellyby, her stays didn't quite match. You know, they didn't quite meet. They were loosely tied. A little detail like that.
I mean,
that,
the little
bang,
description of Phil, who works with George in the shooting gallery, the dirty hands. You can sort of just see it.
Yes, yes, yes.
As you said, well, it's a bit cinematic.
Well, it's a little bit like Sherlock Holmes. You know, I know that you are are a cat lover who forgot to feed the cat because you got hair on the. He would notice these little details. He had an eye for the detail that distinguished someone's trait. And people talk about types. You know, Dickens saw people in caricature. You go through life, you look at people around you. So many people are caricatures. That is unfortunately how we are.
Yeah, and there were a few, and he could succeed with a few thousand caricatures, which he did so brilliantly.
Like I say, about 80 characters, I think. I can't remember, I might be wrong by 20, and there might be 100.
And he forgets half of them halfway through, and the reader forgets them. But then when they come back, that's right, you're the one with the curls in the hair, or you're the ones with the dirty fingernails, or you're the one with something else.
Yeah, you're the one that carried a handkerchief in a certain way, or was forever sniffing, or, yeah, exactly right. But also the names always help, you know. The lawyer Tulkinghorn, you get the idea, you know. The lawyer Voles,
You call someone Snagsby and you think, well, okay, they're a slightly ridiculous character, but they're also a bit of a caring character. Rouncewell's what a fantastic surname. And he took a lot of time thinking and testing out names.
He did indeed. And the names are so evocative. And again, you know, with you mentioned Snagsby. Mr. Snagsby turns out to be a minor hero of this story.
Good character.
Fanatically jealous of him. There's nothing to be jealous about. But here again, the characteristic of him that he keeps giving Joe and others a little coin, don't tell Mrs. Snagsby. And he gives a little coin. Wherever he goes, just gives a little coin, don't tell the wife. And in fact, that's one of his secrets, that she thinks something's up and makes him even more jealous. But, you know, those characteristic defining things about people.
Just little and character traits and just little turning moments like that.
Exactly right.
Okay, brilliant. I think we've got time for one more question. This was sent through by a few different people, but I'll quote Matthew Fagan's one. So Dickens' books were serialized in magazines before being printed as full books. This is something that was very popular back in the day. It's no longer popular. Books just come out as one big book, and obviously we have TV shows that come
like
out.
Like binge TV series.
Yeah, yeah. So what does that sort of bring to a book that you like, and what does it sort of subtract the idea of serialization?
You do get the cliffhanger end of chapter, but that's now reinvented, isn't it, John? I mean, you go through, you know, I'm not saying Joe Nesbo is Charles Dickens, but you go through Joe Nesbo book or whatever like that, you will get the cliffhanger at the end of a chapter.
You go through West Wing, you go through my favourite Friday Night Lights TV series, you go through Breaking Bad. He developed out of the serialisation. I think one of the things that you don't get from reading the book in one go is the journey over a period of years and months. And they would talk, and again, you look at the books talking about Dickens, and people would buy the pamphlet, hand it on. They would talk about it. What's going to happen? Have you read this? Have you seen this? And it was an emotional experience, I suppose, like we get with movies or TV series, or these days, I dare say, like MasterChef or something. The community travelled with Dickens, whereas this is sometimes like an overload of chocolate.
No, but I think it's interesting that, I mean, you mentioned, I think you're onto something there by mentioning something like Breaking Bad. But the more the Netflix thing or the Stan or the new series that we have binge watching in, which is endlessly long, you know, Game of Thrones long, and every chapter or episode is a chapter. When you write like that, A, you can sustain a journey over a longer period.
Yes, which you can
do. If you're standing and writing a book in one go, that's harder. That's much harder. Two, you can people it with many more characters and then lose them along the journey. They will do for that chapter. They will do for that episode. And I think that may explain the richness of all those characters in Dickens, that he could do that. He could be profligate that way.
And he starts a character and might not know how they end.
So
a couple of times he'd draw a character on from real life, and Skimpole is one such example, and then they would complain, and then halfway through he'd have to turn the character from bad to good or good to bad.
Skimpole never ends up that good, though.
No, he doesn't.
Which is something that happens a lot in TV shows. Characters start out bad, they become good. I'm thinking Jamie Lannister from Game of Thrones. Very bad guy.
The actor wants a pay rise, and they have to kill them off.
No, but you can play with the character a little more too, and from the feedback you get from the audience and thinking about it, you can play with the thing as you go along. I think one of Dickens' books, I'm trying to remember, where people were upset about how he was treating a certain character, and he changed as he went on. But that said, like I say, this is like a meditation. You know, the narrative is there in this book, and I presume that he had a vague idea of Esther. It goes about Esther Summerson and a woman that she believes is her mother, and I won't go through that. But that's and the Jarndyce case. Those are the two big narrative threads, and Joe is the character that which around all this whirls. But every chapter is essentially a meditation, as I say, about love and duty and responsibility. And then you can have one chapter on that and one chapter on this, and you don't need that great, you know, arrow of narrative to take you through.
You mean like Jordan Peterson?
No,
but we're always going to experience a book that's written 150 years ago. You're going to experience differently today than then. But you know, I deliberately mention Jordan Peterson because while Dickens can write nicely, the reader does have to work a bit. You do have to follow sometimes quite closely, and not everything is explained at the beginning or the middle. And
but I find it's
you know, I'm going through my big Jordan Peterson period, and people say, "How can you watch a 2-hour lecture that doesn't have a point?" I said, "Well, that's the point." Dickens does get to the point at the end, as I think Peterson does.
I think all the characters make points. Look, I take what you're saying, that if you're reading in the modern way, in our time
on the train for 10 minutes.
If you're reading for the message, if you're reading for the plot,
right.
get
that's
to
right.
the business.
Yeah.
You're reading to get through.
Tell me what happens. Tell me what happens.
Exactly.
Tell me,
information. This is the information. Give me the information.
Yeah.
I think that's right. And this has fallen out of favor. But I think in the Netflix period now, we're in a different thing. A lot of people now are looking for to immerse themselves in another world, right? And they don't need, you know, the 1.5 hour movie, tell us in 90 minutes, the whole thing. That's now starting to look really too superficial, too
easy,
begin to end and finish. And I haven't explored it. I haven't buried myself in it.
I haven't watched a 14-hour video of a train journey.
Correct.
But it is something to that.
In that sense, I'm actually enjoying the language. I'm enjoying the jokes. I'm enjoying the characters. If you see that, if you're just burying yourself, I'm going to sit and Dickinson, have a chapter and just go into it and have a laugh, that's different. But who's got that time anymore? You certainly didn't.
I did in the end.
No, but I'm saying the fact that it's 900 words, this is not a book
pages,
for
yes,
a guy as busy as you. It just isn't.
But you,
unless you're really determined to do it and you have me on the phone saying, John, have you finished?
And James saying, when are we recording the podcast?
Yeah.
But it was completely worth it.
Okay, I might call the podcast there. Thank you so much, guys. That was a really, really fun chat. And thank you so much for listening. Thank you so much to our listeners for sending through those really interesting questions. So tune in a fortnight's time when we discuss The Leopard.